Welcome to Genzoe Sesshin, taking up Dogen's essay on bodhicitta, one of two fascicles in the Shobogenzo. This is the essay for this sesshin, and you can keep it with you at your seat. And usually in sesshin we put aside a lot of extra things like reading and writing, but in a Genzoe sesshin like this, if you'd like to keep this with you and look at it, read it during breaks, you're welcome to. Before we get into Dogen's essay, some background on bodhicitta. A vast topic. Some might even say it's the central issue in the Mahayana bodhisattva vehicle is arousing the unsurpassed mind, giving rise to the altruistic mind that wishes to be a Buddha, be completely awake for the benefit of all beings. Sometimes it's said that there's three motivations or intentions for practice of Buddha Dharma. I think this is a wonderful thing to look at because though it's an ancient teaching, we can apply it to our situation now. What is our aspiration? What is our motivation? What's our intention to do any kind of practice? Daily zazen, anything we think of as practice. Coming to sesshin is a huge undertaking, right? So why are we here? What is this all about? So all of these motivations, I would say, are good. They're reasons to practice that's helpful. But they're, you know, can be classified as like kind of lesser middling and greater motivations. Maybe from the perspective of the bodhisattva path. So one simple motivation is to practice for happiness, to be happy and at ease and free from suffering, in a kind of like immediate way, and not necessarily long-lasting way, but just right now I'm suffering, I'm going to practice to find a little peace right now because I'm really stressed today. So I'm going to sit down and do zazen to kind of relax this stress to go on with the rest of my day. I think this is a good motivation, although it's considered, you know, the first, you know, when you hear about the other ones, maybe see how they can be seen as more or less vast and inclusive. But I think this is a reason why many of us come to practice, is like basic, like temporary happiness today, for ourselves, basically. This is why I came to practice. I don't know if it's true for most people, but especially when we're first coming to practice, right? This is, I think, often our motivation. We don't just kind of randomly have the thought, I want to save all beings from all suffering. I mean, some people might, but I think it's rare. And we have many types of meditative practices in the modern world that are, I would say, would fall into this. And we don't denigrate them in any way. I think these are really great. But for example, mindfulness-based stress reduction, I think is about kind of like a moment-to-moment ease and happiness in this life. And you know, there's good benefits to this for others too, but I think the emphasis in those teachings is like finding your own peace here and now. And not necessarily like the peace of nirvana, right? More like reduced stress. We could maybe call this first motivation the reduction of stress. Again, thinking of my own path to practice in college, sitting with different Zen groups, and well, how did I get into that? I think in some ways I wasn't even so aware of my own suffering. I think there was, you know, the stress of college, so I think that was part of it, but I think my initial impulse, at least outwardly, seemed to be, you know, I was a hippie, psychedelic, mind explorer kind of guy. So I think getting into Zen for me was like, let's explore this mind in a different way. It was that kind of more curiosity than great suffering, maybe initially. And so I was pretty into practice that way. And then I think as I got into it more, because I was quiet and still with myself, I started to reveal more and more of my own stress and suffering and attachments. And then it kind of shifted into that motivation just by actually doing the practice. My first longer term relationship in college was coming to an end, and so it was my first breakup. And that was extreme suffering for me. I was just like burning with attachment, aversion, jealousy, self-pity. It goes on and on, right? And I felt like this is really bad. I'm usually like pretty okay, but this situation is like throwing me into like kind of insanity. I'd wake up in the morning and just immediately be like, feel not happy to be alive. Like, oh, I'm still in this situation. And just feeling like this is a mind-created hell realm. And I have this practice that I feel like addresses some of this. So I think this is what I have to take care of first and foremost. Just like find a little bit of sanity here. So this was when I was graduating and I was trying to decide what to do next, and I had various options to become a farmer or to go to a Zen center. Were the two kind of like things I was sort of like weighing at that point. And because this whole very painful situation was happening at this time, that's what tipped me towards the you know, I do want to take up this farming thing at some point, but first I need to deal with this insanity of this one and find a little peace, even just a little. We weren't talking about nirvana here. I'm just like, I'm insane. I'm looking for a little bit of peace. So I think this is this first motivation. And it was good. It was healthy. It was like what I needed. And I need to do it like full time. I'm already meditating, but like I'm going to put all my attention into this because I'm extremely insane right now. And so I'm going to Green Gulch Farm, or Tassajara, I guess it was. So that was my initial motivation to practice. And then, as you know, I got more into it and kept doing it, I started hearing these teachings and studying these teachings about, for example, nirvana, the complete cessation of suffering, the irreversible freedom. They sometimes talk about non-regression. So therefore, it's not like a temporary thing. Like you meditate a little and you feel a little peaceful and then you get totally stressed again. And my understanding of these teachings were like that Buddha's awakened ones have found this way to realize the unconditioned peace of nirvana, the complete cessation of suffering in a way where it doesn't even arise again. And it's not conditioned, that peace, it's not conditioned by anything, not even conditioned by doing a lot of zazen. It's like the Buddhas could stop doing zazen and they wouldn't be able to suffer anymore. That's my understanding of the traditional teaching of the complete cessation of suffering for an arhat or a Buddha. Well, hearing about that and, you know, not being an arhat or Buddha, but feeling like, is this a made-up story or is it really true? And then, you know, the more we practice, the more we, especially in sesshin and more intensive practice, we sometimes can touch those places of, you know, for a second or two. Maybe we're actually, we have some sense that like, oh, I can see with that there can be an unconditioned peace, and it's not irreversible for me. But these teachings make more and more sense. I don't think it's just a far-fetched story. I think this is possible. I think it's very rare and takes a lot of work. But there's this possibility in this world. I came to have faith. My faith grew in this through my own experience and through hearing the teachings. And being with people who practiced a while and seem to be finding this some of the time. So I think in that way, this is the second motivation for practice. The first is just this kind of temporary happiness here and now that can come and go by just, you know, reducing stress for now. The second motivation is more like the permanent happiness of nirvana. We maybe feel a little bit funny hearing that. Really? Is it permanent happiness? I thought everything's impermanent. But traditionally, everything is impermanent. But there's some non-things that are permanent, like nirvana is unchanging, peaceful bliss and freedom. And so that's the second motivation. Still for oneself, I want to not just be free of stress right now and then have to deal with it again tomorrow. I want to actually practice with the motivation to realize the unchanging peace of nirvana. Be done with the cycle of suffering, life after life. I think probably people have heard of it. It's a big kind of topic, this thing of nirvana, because we have the early teachings about it, where you're ending rebirth completely. Rebirth, moment to moment, birth into a cycle of suffering. And from life to life, it's like the end. And it's inconceivable, even in the early teachings, the Buddha said. He talked about it, but, you know, our conceptual mind is not going to get a grasp on this because the conceptual mind is the conditioned mind of suffering. And so both of these motivations are, we could call, like, the path of the Shravakas. From a Bodhisattva perspective, it's like a lesser vehicle. We're not connecting this with Theravada Buddhism, but we're just saying it's the approach that's not as vast as the Mahayana Bodhisattva perspective. But still, in the Shravaka Yana, the practices of kindness and compassion are totally important. So, of course, arhats and Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas have great kindness and compassion. They need that to realize this peace of Nirvana. But in a way, they're practicing the kindness and compassion in order to reach Nirvana. It's part of the program. Not so much for the people that they're being kind and compassionate to. So, as you can probably guess, the third greatest motivation for practice is not just the temporary happiness for ourselves, not permanent, unchanging peace and happiness for ourselves, but the unchanging peace and happiness for all beings. That we, whatever that takes, which maybe takes becoming completely, understanding how this works to become completely free and at peace, and then guiding and helping all sentient beings in all realms of existence to this peace and unchanging freedom also. And we could even add to it and help them become bodhisattvas so they can help others too. So this one, is the Mahayana motivation, very infinitely vast. So three motivations for practice. I think it's nice because we can sort of check where we are. Even day to day, it might be like, most of the time I'm actually in the first motivation. I'm actually just looking for a little ease now, and I actually have some doubts about this Nirvana thing anyway, because it sounds good. I think this is, we have to be really honest with ourselves, right? Where are we really at? Do we think I'd like to believe it's true, but in my deepest heart, I think these were very creative, imaginative people who wrote down these sutras and treatises long ago, and they're very enthusiastic, but I don't know if it's really true. Sometimes I feel like that. I have to question, So I think the more we hear these teachings, reflect on these teachings in our own experience, and then try them out or, taste them a little bit here and there, these things kind of build our faith and trust. Well, maybe it is possible. If we feel a little bit it is possible, then there's the next question of well, it's theoretically possible in this world for people to realize this, but I don't know about me, actually, because I have a lot of karmic hindrances, and things like the stories about those people who practice that way were like doing practices that I can't quite imagine myself. So, sounds great. I think it's possible, but and I'd like to be up for it eventually, but maybe not in this lifetime. Again, sometimes I feel this way when I'm being really honest with myself. And then we can have the kind of sort of irrational, a little bit crazy spirit of I think it is possible. I don't know if it's possible for me, but I'm just gonna go for it. I'm gonna put my life energy in that direction, because what else? What could be more important? And especially with this third one, I want to put my life energy in this direction of freeing all beings completely from all suffering. It's so vast, it's so intense, We say it all the time. We recite these four vows all the time. But I feel like when I really take it to heart and look deeply, I feel sometimes even look queasy or like a little like just this reservation, like, really? Do you really mean that? And then we have all our ways too of kind of like maybe interpreting this kind of thing to make it a little more easy, like saving all beings. Well, it doesn't really mean like freeing all living beings from all suffering. It just means when you meet somebody on the path, you're nice to them. That's saving all beings. So I think that is part of it, saving all beings, but I don't think it's the whole thing. So, but we can all say that. You know, when I say I sometimes have doubts, I don't have any reservations about wanting to be completely kind and compassionate to all beings and try to, you know, let go of my attachments. It's not so hard. I mean, if we have never heard of practice, we maybe don't even get into that. But as practitioners, it's not so hard to feel like, yeah, of course I want all that. But to kind of like, do I have the resolve or the vow or the commitment to go like all the way with this or what, and whatever it takes? I might say, yeah, sure, whatever it takes. It wouldn't take that much, right? The Buddhas are kind to me. They're not going to ask too much of me. What if, like, whatever it takes, because it might take a lot. It seems like it might take a lot. And then what if the Buddhas ask us to give up that which we're most attached to? You know, we might have our limits. I think this Bodhisattva vow is, you know, in the end, it's kind of like beyond any limits. And that's where, for me, when I get very personal with looking at this, I feel like, I don't know, am I really willing to let go of everything for all beings, beings that I maybe don't even like? Yes, no, no.
I feel kind of stuck on the doing something now for something later issue, which the way you're talking about these other motivations is kind of how I'm seeing, you know, doing a practice now for nirvana later.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel weary thinking about it that way.
Yeah.
Just putting all that aside and doing everything now.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that I can meet right now, and then the rest I just can't worry about it.
Mm. That's a great point. Yeah, what about this future orientation that seems to be in maybe any motivation? If we're ever talking about these words like motivation and aspiration and intention and resolve and vow, they all seem to be directed towards the future in my way of thinking, usually, how we use those words. Because if it's just right this moment, it's not like I vow to let go of everything right now. It's more like I just let go of everything right now. At least that's the way, in my mind, when I hear the word vow, it usually implies like now and into the future. So I think that is an interesting point that Dogen, I think, will address this, because he's really into now. The Zen tradition is into like, it's all right now. And it's bodhicitta must be right now. So let's keep exploring that and see, could there also be a kind of aspiration that, you know, starts now? Because I think if it's only about the future, then it's another way to fool ourselves. Yeah, yeah, I want to be a Buddha, you know, and however long it takes, and just many, many lifetimes, there's a long time to do it, so right now, I'll just do whatever. Tomorrow I'll start. So that's the problem with the future, one of the problems with the future thing. maybe some versions of that are the whole problem with it, like just that it must be right now. But I think there's a way to set a kind of an orientation, because it might feel like, well, I really want to just, you know, let go of everything for all beings as my life direction, starting right now. And I might feel like, but I'm failing right now. Okay, but I'll try again. And so this long-term thing, not really with any end in mind, it doesn't have, it more just like endlessly, from this life on throughout countless lives, we vow to continue. And therefore, when we like, if we miss in this moment, we have another moment. That's part of it. Talk to you.
For me, instead of being overwhelmed by the vow, which immediately do that, I get refuge by being incremental and doing what I can do right now in whatever way, and not look at the bigger picture, but keep it small so that it's one step at a time. It's just trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And then, to some degree, you alleviate that overwhelming aspiration or the overwhelming vows, because when you look at that bigger picture, it's nothing but overwhelming.
Yeah. So I agree, it has to be like one step at a time. But I wonder if that one step at a time is based on this larger context that we might call aspiration. We might not even be thinking of it as like, I vow, I aspire this way. But we maybe do, in order to take that step right now, there must be a motivation behind it. And it, I mean, part of the story here too is that every action we do, according to Buddha Dharma, is based on an intention, some intention. So, you know, okay, right now, just let go. But there was an intention there. We might not call it a huge vow or aspiration, but we could call that intention the mind just before letting go. It was like, it could be called bodhicitta, possibly. We might not think of it as such. Yes, Kathy?
Yeah. I think there's always two sides. And I think that remembering that it's all now is obviously really important. And I think that the strategy of incremental, so that you don't get overwhelmed, is a very great strategy. And I also think that there is real liberation in when we can opening to the big picture. Because I think that can help encourage us as well. Obviously, if it's overwhelming, then it's not helpful, you know. And I know I have that same thing sometimes. I'm just like, I'm just not going to think about it. I'm just going to look at today, right? But sometimes it can be the opposite. It can be liberating and relieving. Like I'm thinking of in work situations, like when I used to teach school. You know, if I thought that the kids were going to keep being the way they were the first month of school, I would quit. But there was a memory of, no, it's actually going to evolve, and in June, they will be different. And that's a future. Even though in the moment, it was just they were doing whatever they did, but the learning, as a practitioner, that people grow and change, you know, that's kind of the future. You know, and I think that's an edge for me, is how to think about that in a way that you don't get, I don't get completely in the future, because I can really be in the future a lot, planning. It has to go a certain way, and then you abandon the present. But on the other hand, it can be very skillful and helpful also to keep in mind that which is a bigger time frame than we can possibly deal with it in the moment.
Yeah,
so
it could.
Want to speak to that
aspect. It could fuel and energize our practice, and also. I was encouraged to find a traditional teaching that says this vow doesn't mean that you like promise that you will never fail and you'll be able to do this. It's just that the actual bodhisattva vow is like an intention, and it's fine And it was natural. It's impossible not to fail. It's a direction. It's just an intention to keep going in this direction. And I think that's important, because if it's like, I don't know whether I should take this up this vow, because if I fail, I probably will fail, so I shouldn't even bother. It's like, no, with this particular vow, it's the direction we're trying to go, in general, and in a moment-to-moment way, starting right now. Yeah. I think if we say, I want to be a Buddha like this for all beings, however long it takes, and kind of skip over the now, again, like, you know, no rush, it's going to take a while. I think that could be a way, that could be a problem with the vastness that undermines the right nowness. Yeah. Yarod.
I don't know, I've always had a hard time with that one, because you have to this kind of enduring state sometime in the future. But I guess the way, and even the language you're using to kind of talk about it, like, you know, how can there be something permanent when everything's impermanent? I guess I think of step number two is more just like a radical opening, which I guess you could even say bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
A radical opening which entails radical acceptance of everything. So it's not about becoming happy. Mm. It's not about finding some permanent happiness, you know, which is something we think of as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Or a certain mood, even.
So it's not about that. It's not, I don't envision that as that, you know, you're never sad or something
yep.
like that. It's a radical acceptance of everything.
Yeah.
Your ups, your downs, the world's ups and downs.
That's a nice way of putting it.
The impermanence of your body
mm-hmm.
and everything else.
Yeah.
So I guess so that it's so radical that you're just able to kind of embrace.
Yes. Yeah. Good point, that it's not happiness, as we usually see. Think of that word. Maybe we could say peace, because it's complete acceptance, it's deep peace and freedom from suffering, but it might actually manifest in various forms that, of sadness or something, but there's complete freedom within that sadness, especially in a kind of Mahayana perspective. Freedom from greed, hate, and delusion doesn't necessarily mean like eradication, like, and we're just some like zombie-like state. But I would say radical, yeah, completely free, and that freedom is kind of I could say unhindered or unshakable peace. Like one's never fooled again into but this is really worth getting upset about. So part of the thing here is this is reached through understanding. This is a wisdom realization of emptiness, no self and emptiness. So from a perspective of self and things substantially existing, it kind of makes no sense, right? Which is the way we're usually thinking. So part of this...
Some self being happy.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
So it's a radical penetration of understanding.
Yeah.
Of just wisdom.
Yeah.
There is no self.
Yeah.
And yet there is this being that feels.
There's appearance of feeling and emotions and so that appearance doesn't stop until parinirvana when even appearances stop. But
I imagine the Buddha felt all kinds of emotions.
Well, we know he had it was physical pain when dying. The radical non-grasping of any state as truly existing. So that's how we can, if it seems like it's just this imaginary description of some state, I wouldn't even say it's a state. Nirvana is not a state. It's like the freedom from all states. Sometimes when we feel like we're really open to that, to the kind of dreamlike quality of this life, and we can start to imagine in a dreamlike way, imagine that, oh, you know, if we really see it's really, none of this is really as real and substantially existent as we think it is, then as if we were in a dream, one could really like be really free from all kinds of stuff, even in this, you know, when the dragon's chasing us in the dream, if we know it's a dream, it's like, okay, this is part of the appearance. And I think that's how we have these stories of like the Buddha feeding his body to the hungry tigress and so on. It's like, if he's thinking, oh no, this is really like a substantial body, and like, I better not do this, I don't think it would be possible. So I think, you know, this nirvana, even the second kind, is really based on the teachings of emptiness, which is like, if they seem not realistic or abstract to us, then so will this possibility. Yes. Not that it is a dream exactly, but it's very much like a dream. It's not what we think it is. This body is not what we think it is. Nice point. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's something, so that's true. So I said Buddha wouldn't, that Bodhisattva wouldn't have been able to do that if he didn't see it somewhat like a dream. I appreciate your point. So I take that back, because I actually don't know what that Bodhisattva thought. But,
well, it would be cheating. In other words, that's like, you know, if you know, you've got to understand. One other thought about suffering, you know, and our real lack of understanding of it. You know, because for me, meaning to be polite and not to have this sound aggressive, I mean, the idea of saving all beings has a nonsensical aspect. You talk about it in different ways. I mean, Chuck says it's, maybe I take it as well. Now that I now understand it, it's nonsense to me, because in my mind, it's not up to me. All this, we all will be saved. There's a flow of inevitability that we don't have any idea about either, but that I trust in the end, everything will be taken care of. It's not up to me, you know, but my sense of this is that I've landed in a thing I can't comprehend. One quote was making peace with the impossible. computers, I look and see I have a body. What can it do? What can I do with it? And it involves practice, because all the things that start to interest me about what can I do, that means anything in the arts or anything in sport, anything in anything, that I'm curious at what can we do with this thing that we give it? You know, we don't even know why, you know, but here it is. Let's see what it can do. It turns out that any attempt with this equipment towards mastery seems to require practice. Seems to require getting out of the way of inspiration or of any doing, you know, that involves the body, still involves removing the idea of self and ego, so that you're freed up to do the thing you're thinking of, at all levels, being in service. And just quickly, I found in my anti-Vietnam War years, there were, I was fighting a war, and one thing another. In the end, I felt like I have a good intention. I know what I want. You know, I want this stinking thing to stop. But I don't have the tools. You know, I need to have a practice that teaches me how to do this, so that I can be effective in it. You know.
Well, one thing in what you said that comes to mind, because I think it's a good point that often doesn't get mentioned, is how can I save all beings? Because all beings will be saved inconceivably, and who am I to do that? Yeah, well, and also I think it has, you know, if we look at this teaching of no independent self, then that brings it, you know, into question this whole bodhicitta thing. So I think that's part of what's going on here, is it's like and this is part of what I wanted to get to this morning too, is these two types of bodhicitta, like conventional and ultimate. And conventional is like when we have a sense of there is me, even though we've heard this teaching, there's no independent self. We do things all day long. We act as if there's a doer. And so from that perspective, that's the one that generates this wish. So from a kind of ultimate perspective, it's a little bit off. It's a little diluted. It's a little bit of like a joke from the ultimate perspective to say, I vow to save all beings. So I think that's a nice point that you bring up. But that's the world we live in. It's the world where, I'm going to have lunch soon, is like, you know, if we're already thinking that way, then in the world where we're thinking we're going to have lunch soon, that's the world where we generate this vow that I will save all beings. But if we look deeper...
And in having lunch, apropos Chuck's comment and other people's, you can smile at the person at the counter. You can have a nice feeling about you. You can have a kindness just as you're going about the little things you do.
Yeah, so... Yeah, they might not be bodhicitta or manifestations of it, though they could be manifestations of it. They can also be conditions for supporting it. So again, kindness and compassion are like the soil and the rain to grow this bodhicitta tree. All of that is like steps and supports for this, both the relative intention and aspiration and the ultimate realization. That's the nice thing about this word bodhicitta. Bodhi means awakening, enlightenment. It's the same root as Buddha. The bud, you know, it's related to the English word bud. It's like the, you know, a flower coming to be, being born, right? As a flower, flowering into fullness is part of the etymology of Buddha and Bodhi. Bodhi defined really is, I think all traditions of Buddha Dharma would say, it is the complete freedom, complete irreversible. Complete irreversible freedom, or you know, unwavering freedom from greed, hate, and delusion, all kinds of attachment, aversion, confusion, and therefore suffering. And I think they'd all agree with that. How they say, what is that freedom from? There may be some disagreement there. It might be like freedom from greed, hate, and delusion in the midst of greed, hate, and delusion. Might be a more non-dual way to talk about it. And then in the Mahayana, part of Bodhi is not just this freedom from greed, hate, attachment, delusion, confusion, aversion, but also the boundless and impartial compassion and love for all sentient beings in all realms. That's the Mahayana addition to Bodhi. Actually, I think it's actually even there in the small vehicle descriptions of a Buddha actually has those qualities too, but they're more emphasized as paramount in the Mahayana. So that's Bodhi, kind of exalted term, and citta just means mind or intention or will or thought even. So it's a nice word because in the relative it means the intention to realize Bodhi for all beings, and in the ultimate it is the mind of Bodhi, right? It's bodhicitta is the awakened mind. So it's the aspiration, the thought to realize awakening, the aspiration for awakening in the relative sense, and it is the awakened mind in ultimate sense. So and it therefore includes the complete culmination of both compassion, the full extent of compassion, and wisdom that realizes selflessness. Yes. So there's the intention, and then there's the vow. We could distinguish those a little bit too. We could say the intention is like, I think it would be a great idea. I do have that. That's the direction I'm going. And then the vow is kind of like a commitment, like, and I will. And often the vow is connected with like a formalized. Kind of statement that I will do this, just like you might have an aspiration to continue to live with someone that you love for the rest of your life, but then at some point you can make a vow, I will live with them for the rest of my life, and it's like that's the commitment. So it's a little different than the aspiration, it's a formalizing, so we have ceremonies to do that. When I was in Nepal a few weeks ago, I was fortunate enough to go to a bodhisattva vow ceremony. So it's sort of like our bodhisattva precepts ceremony, but as bodhisattva precepts are closely connected, support for bodhicitta, but it's a little different because in our ceremony we don't actually recite those four vows. You could say the precepts are an expression of that, but my teacher, Tenshin Roshi, in the last few years, I've been studying these bodhisattva trainings and so on, and he's felt like, well, we don't really fully include that in our bodhisattva precepts ordinations, so we should have another bodhisattva vow ceremony. So he's actually doing this now as an annual event at No Abode. I think there's one next month where he's going to the kind of Indian tradition where they have these ceremonies and where people take the bodhisattva vow to save, to become a Buddha for all beings. Because he feels like, oh, this is like important enough that let's, even though it's not in our Soto tradition, let's do this ceremony. It's quite interesting, I think. Well, we don't really say like quite like that, right? In the full moon ceremony, we do say the four vows that are really bodhicitta, bodhisattva vows, and but they're not in the Jukai. We could add them in there, but we do have these three pure precepts, and all the bodhisattva precepts are kind of part of it. And that's this class series we'll have starting next week on these asangas. Presentation of his connection of these three pure precepts with bodhicitta. But it's a little different. Anyway, part of the breakdown of thinking about bodhicitta here, because we can find this stuff in Dogen when we start getting into Dogen, is as a nice way of, you know, classifying things. The Indian tradition likes to do that, right? Break down things into different aspects. So there's the aspiration bodhicitta and implementation bodhicitta. Another way to say it is intention and application. So intention or aspiration bodhicitta and application or implementation bodhicitta. These are both part of relative bodhicitta now. Remember, the relative is the in the world where we think that we're a person doing things and making intentions and so on. In that world, we have the intention and the application. And Shantideva, who's one of the great expounders of bodhicitta, right, puts it like this: wishing to depart and setting out on the road, this is how the difference is conceived between these two. So it's like, I'd like to go to San Francisco. I have the intention to go to San Francisco, is the aspiration or intention. And then actually getting on the bus, setting out on the road, taking the first step is the application or implementation. So it's a nice way to think about it, because we've been talking about that a little bit. I think of this discussion about the future orientation. It's so much about this idea and thought. I'll do this, but, you know, maybe later. So that is part of it, is generating an intention and aspiration. It's just a thought that you can do in zazen without moving a particle. And then there's the implementation. It's like, now I'm going to either continue to sit here, depending what the intention is, or get up and do something, starting to set out. And so often the application, how you set out on the path to start enacting this intention, can you guess what that might be in the Mahayana applications? Any guesses?
The setting out
part? Yeah, the setting out. Yeah, what do you start doing to enact this intention?
Well,
I think,
you know, feeding yourself to the tiger, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. So all of these things that you start doing. So we have this, the classic way, the kind of sixfold way, is these six paramitas, right? these perfections. So I really want to do this practice. How should I do it? I feel this wish. I want to, like, you know, realize this complete freedom. And again, people might feel like, is that selfish to just want this freedom and then I'll benefit beings? Well, it's like the freedom from self-centeredness. So it completely goes together. Freedom from greed, hate, and delusion means I am just like available bodhisattva to all beings. So I wish that, I intend that, I aspire to that. So I got that going. That's my I've generated the thought. I've aroused that wish. Now what? Now what do I do? I'm ready to go. What should I do? Well, we have these six practices. I think just wonderful because you can always do them. They're giving, all kinds of giving, generosity, virtue or ethical conduct, precepts. This is how you enact this, right? Patience when things get rough and difficult. Vigor or enthusiasm or diligence means like we're not going to give up, keep going with great enthusiastic energy when it seems ridiculous. And presence or meditative concentration, we emphasize a lot this week. And then wisdom that permeates them all, and you could say perfects those other four practices, because really these two sides of like you're accumulating merit, and which is like this positive energy that's fueling this path to Buddhahood for all beings, and you're accumulating wisdom. And so like giving, the first five are like accumulating this positive energy. So you're giving, when you combine it with wisdom, it's like you're giving without the thought of you as the giver, the person you're giving to as the receiver, and the gift that you're giving, without seeing those seeing no separation between giver, receiver, and gift, is like perfects the giving. You could say, well, if you see no separation, why bother giving? That's the amazing beauty of this bodhisattva path. You see that it's the emptiness of giver, receiver, and gift, and then you keep giving. So that's this inconceivable, wonderful practice that unites the dreamlike appearances of a body that can give gifts to other bodies. You don't say, well, it just doesn't matter because it's just a dream. You totally get into this giving, and at the same time you can't find any real me, you, or any gift, or even any act of giving. So it's giving beyond giving. And the same with the other practices of virtue and patience and diligence and zazen. So we have these aspiration, bodhicitta, the wish to go that way, and then the implementation or application is basically these six perfections of the bodhisattvas. And then we also have this teaching of these 3 degrees of courage of the bodhisattvas. When giving rise to bodhicitta, there's like 3 types of bodhicitta, but they're sometimes called 3 types of courage. So there's the courage of a king. So that when text puts it like this, a king's first priority is to overcome all his rivals, promote those who support him, and proclaim himself sovereign. Only after that does his wish to take care of his subjects come into effect. Similarly, the wish first to attain Buddhahood for oneself and then to bring others to Buddhahood is called the king's way of arousing bodhicitta. So, can you follow that? It might sound, well, isn't that kind of selfish? But actually, it's bodhicitta. You're becoming the strong ruler in order to then help your subjects, right? Or you're becoming a Buddha, maybe like temporarily putting aside helping sentient beings to really break through into Buddha mind, and then you can get to work on that. And that's the reason you want to do it, is to help all beings. So it is a kind of bodhicitta. Yeah, maybe like master. Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a valid type of bodhicitta, the king-like bodhicitta. Then there's the courage of a boat pilot. A boat pilot aims to arrive on the other shore together with all her passengers. Likewise, the wish to achieve Buddhahood for oneself and all beings at the same time is called the boat pilot's way of arousing bodhicitta. So the king is like, I'll go first to help all beings. And the boat pilot is like, we all go together. I'm kind of, you know, steering the boat, taking you with me, but we all arrive at the other shore exactly the same time. And then the third is the courage of a shepherd. Shepherds drive their sheep in front of them, making sure that they find grass and water and are not attacked by wolves, jackals, or other wild beasts. They themselves follow behind. In the same way, the attitude of those who wish to establish all beings of all worlds in perfect Buddhahood before achieving it for themselves is called the shepherd's way of arousing bodhicitta. So, me first, we all go together, or you first.
Sounds like the
parents'
way.
Parents' way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, ideally, you're thinking about
a kid's wish. Yeah. Yep. And then this is Patro Rinpoche, a great teacher in Tibet. The king's way, called arousing bodhicitta with the great wish, is the least courageous of the three. The boat pilot's way, called arousing bodhicitta with sacred wisdom, is more courageous. It's said that the great Maitreya bodhisattva aroused bodhicitta in this way. The shepherd's way, called arousing a bodhicitta beyond compare, is the most courageous of all. It is said to be the way that the great Manjushri bodhisattva aroused bodhicitta. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's separate words, and I know in other languages or ways of being, it's like there isn't this dichotomy.
Yeah.
But when you use the word courage, that's, you know, the basis that is cur or heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if the, in the citta.
Yes.
That's
true.
It is a kind of mind-heart kind of thing. There's no.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, both in Indian and Chinese tradition. Citta could be also translated as heart. There are other, you know, like Hridaya means heart very literally, but citta can be translated as heart as well as mind or thought. And shin in Japanese, the Chinese character, can also be translated as mind or heart. So bodai shin, hotsu bodai shin, arousing bodhicitta. So, In English, heart and mind have a different feeling, but it's like the heart mind. It's a, what is that? We can't say. It's inconceivable, this heart mind, but it includes emotions, it includes this feeling, like compassion. We maybe would call a heart thing, but could also call a mind thing.
Yeah.
It is. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can find words in Sanskrit that point more clearly to mind and more towards heart, but citta is kind of universal in that way. But I think these three courages, these three hearts, and which are more heartful, is an interesting thing to look at too, because we might say, well, which one am I there? As well as we have these three motivations for practice. There are three types of bodhicitta. Which one do we resonate with? I find it's an interesting thing to contemplate because the king way, it feels to me like most, in a certain way, most like rational. Because like, if you're trying to lead all beings to Buddhahood, how could you do that without being a Buddha, right? How do you know? Maybe you should study this sutra and really embody it completely, but like, I'm not really sure if it's right or not. But try it. Please do it, and tell me if it's right once you get there. You know, it's kind of like, really? That's kind of like the you first way, right? Or like, how do we have the skillful means to, of course we can help people, but to actually guide them to complete Buddhahood, which is what I think save actually means. How can you do without being the king, even though it seems a little more self-centered? And then just to think of it, just another thought about these other two, the one all going together way kind of seems like, in a certain way, makes the most, from a non-dual perspective, we maybe say that makes the most sense. Of course, we're always all together. And when one, you know, like from Dogen's point of view, it's like, you know, when you sit zazen completely, all beings in the three realms, including all worlds, including the three lower realms, at once obtain pure body and mind and realize great emancipation. Right? So it's like, you're sitting zazen, immediately everybody is free from suffering. That's kind of like, that has some resonance, I think, with the ferry pilot. Like, because we're actually one mind and one heart, we're all always together at the same time. And then this way of, the shepherd way of everyone first, does seem the most loving and compassionate and is called the greatest courage. And in Dogen's Hotsu Bodaishin, which we'll study in the fall, that's what he really pushes, is like, you have to wish that everybody else first, he keeps saying. It's a little different than the essay we have this Sashin, and maybe it's in response to that. People, this is it. I think this Hotsu Mujoshin that we study this week has a maybe more ultimate perspective, maybe a little bit. And the Hotsu Bodaishin, Dogen's other fascicle, has a more like, you really gotta like want everybody else to be completely free first. So Dogen really, in that essay, really emphasizes the shepherd way. Yes?
The conditions change. It could be a parent with children, and then what would be the best way of approaching that? I think, obviously, the kingly way, because you want to be an adult, that sets an example.
Yeah.
I also think that the kingly way, I'm agreeing with you, I'm thinking it's not the least, I think it's the most, because what it says is that even when you're doing things together, like organizing with workers to accomplish something for a union or civil rights, whatever, that what you bring, even though you're doing it now together, all for one for all, the degree of the quality that you bring to that group really makes a difference. So if you take responsibility for really bringing the maturity to this movement, that's now a group movement, that's very different than coming and being a follower and dragging along and not really knowing what you're doing there. And so it comes to me in all the examples, it'll always be the best if you took care of yourself first, not in a selfish way, but in a way that made you mature, so that whether you were doing it as a teacher or a parent or in an organization all together, or in the sort of unimaginable way of everybody else doing it first and then pulling you, that sounds the most selfish. It seems like the best way of doing it is what we do, practice and try and get ourselves together so that we can do these other things.
Yeah, I mean, there's that one side, and maybe a modern example we could use is my teachers brought up is when, which I heard a lot recently because I've been on a lot of airplanes. When they make the announcement, they're like, in the event of an emergency, the oxygen masks will come from the ceiling. And if you're with a child, put the mask on yourself first before you put it on the child. So, and the reason is because otherwise you're going to pass out and not be able to help either one of you. Right? So I think that's an interesting example of this kind of principle of like, you put it on yourself first so you make sure that you can really help the child. But I just want to clarify, I'm not saying that that one's best. I just said when I'm looking at these that it was the most rational. To me, to my rational mind, it kind of like, well, doesn't that make the most sense? But part of the beauty of these other ones, especially the shepherd one, is it's not so rational. Like, how do you do that? you say, good luck to you, but it's more than that. I really vow to, like, bring you to Buddhahood before me, and even though I don't know how. And but this, to me, it's beautiful because it's not so rational, right? I mean, I totally see your point too, but especially for me with this, I have a very rational mind. Well, then let's do the king way. But like, how about just actually like giving up the way that we're gonna think we're gonna do this, and like a shepherd, I don't know how we're gonna help everyone realize this, but like, that's the spirit. And then I think, well, it doesn't make sense. How could you do it? But my rational mind starts arguing, and then I think this whole thing is like just mind stuff, right? We're just talking about attitudes and spirits of practice. So in that way, it's like, if you try to work it out logically, it's gonna maybe fall apart. But the spirit of practice is like, is the great courage, is like, you first. The leap of faith. And we might say, actually, a rational thought just popped into my mind. Excuse me. Which is that maybe the way that that works rationally is if you have that spirit really completely, really fully, like, I really do just wish for all you to be free first. I give up my own freedom for you completely. That actually the secret, small print here, is that that attitude is becoming the king, right? That is enlightenment. It's like you're free, you're completely free from self-centeredness is basically what we're talking about when we're saying enlightenment. So it's kind of like just becoming completely free of self-centeredness in that way, then you become the king, but you don't know you're the king. You think you're just a shepherd. But actually, then the sheep are like, wow, that king is like, I mean, that shepherd is totally selfless. He's totally setting the way. And the shepherd's like, I don't know what you guys should do, but I really want you sheep to go first. Yes, Jerry. Yeah.
Can you have bodhicitta, it's something you maybe already know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's part of what's going on here too, yeah. And I think Dogen will bring this out even more. But one way is just, you know, there's the relative and the ultimate bodhicitta that we talked about, that the relative is just arousing this aspiration as a little human being, thinking of this vast potential. And then the ultimate is the mind of enlightenment, the awakened mind, our, you know, Buddha nature that we already are, and it's already here completely. And you could say that the relative aspiration does come from the actually awakened mind that we already have. So I think that's a great point, is that how can we arouse such an aspiration? From our little self-centered point of view, it seems impossible. But that's our little self-centered view. Our awakened mind that's already like free of limitations and you know, limits, yeah, does have no problem. Our Buddha nature has no problem vowing to save all beings. And so when bodhicitta, the relative bodhicitta actually arises, truly, like, I really do feel this aspiration, and I'm gonna do it for not even me, but like, we see it's coming through me. The Buddha mind is coming through this five skandhas, this little version of this sentient being. It's coming through and manifesting as this aspiration. So yeah, I think for it truly to arise, it only can truly arise if we actually have this awakened mind, or if we are this awakened mind. And you could say, this is again the Buddha nature teaching, is it's all here, but it's just obscured by our limited ideas of ourself as this little being that can't save all beings. But it can shine through that limitation of like, I can't do it. Buddha can come through and say, no, that's right, you can't do it, but this aspiration can arise in this body and mind. And Dogen will play with this. He'll play with these two levels of, it's already completely here, and you have to do these simple little actions at the same time. Again, it's two truths. So, yeah. There's lots that Dogen says, actually, too. He's like, about the same point, that bodhicitta doesn't come from you, like you as the little sentient being cannot really arouse bodhicitta, and it doesn't really come from Buddha, like the vast nature of mind that you are. It comes from the meeting of the sentient being and the Buddha, in this sometimes called mystical communion with the sentient being and the Buddha. I mean, we could think of Buddha as a kind of external, but we could say that who you think you are and your own Buddha nature, the meeting of those two is in that communion. That's where bodhicitta is born. Yeah, and so, yeah, not that different. Another thing that Dogen says, both the previous statement and this one are from his second essay, Hotsubo Daishin. He says, like the initial aspiration to realize awakening, the initial beginner's mind bodhicitta, like, I want to do this practice for all beings, is like a tiny, like, Or more like, maybe we'll make it more clear, we'd say, the initial impulse of like, I want to practice and be a Buddha, is like a tiny little firefly, spark of the light of a firefly, and then complete perfect awakening itself is like a raging firestorm that burns up the entire universe at the end of the kalpa. It's like the biggest fire you could imagine. So that's how you could compare that initial wish to be a Buddha with the actual realization of Buddhahood. And then Dogen says, however, if you add into this wish to become a Buddha, that you wish all other beings to realize this freedom before you, he says, then the difference between that firefly and the raging firestorm is no difference at all. They're exactly the same. So this is, and when you say, it sounds like it's also the place of enlightenment. He's like, that's where he's saying, bodhicitta, this thought, and the actual unsurpassed perfect enlightenment itself are actually no different. And Dogen says, what makes them not different is the wish of others first. This is a really radical statement. Maybe the most awesome piece of that essay, I think. Because it's, again, it's too much. Doesn't it seem too much to say that? That little shift of just, but you know, that little shift of others first is basically just forgetting the self. And as Dogen says, to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things, and your body and mind then drop away. So it is to completely forget one's small self is this complete awakening. So there's a lot of interplay between this relative bodhicitta and the ultimate bodhicitta. They're not so far apart, and yet sometimes they can seem really far apart.
Well, it's interesting to me that this seems to be a human, only a human process and condition, because animals don't seem to aspire to anything other than what they are, and they don't seem to put other beings.
Well, it seems that, yeah, I mean, they say that the human is the most common place for bodhicitta to arise, but again, in the tradition we have these Jataka tales, you know, previous lives of Shakyamuni Buddha. These whole volumes of, they're like fables of all these lives where the Buddha was often an animal. And in these stories, as an animal, he would do these compassionate activities. And we heard the story last night, for those who were here, about the Bodhisattva who would become the Buddha in a hell, as a hell being. So he wasn't actually human there, he was in this hell, a hell dweller, and actually practiced kindness. Maybe it wasn't complete bodhicitta, but the wish to be completely awake and skillful to benefit all beings. But I don't know, there may be stories that even in these other realms, beings could, that could happen. But it seems like part of the story in the tradition too is that humans, like where our faculties are really clear and we can hear these kind of teachings and understand them more easily than other realms. So we have more potential, which is why one of the factors to help generate and support bodhicitta, either once it's born to help it grow or to give rise to it, is to contemplate how rare and wonderful an opportunity it is to be living as a human for this little lifespan, because this is our chance to generate this aspiration. Because I know this is a controversial topic because it gets into the whole rebirth thing, right? But we don't know what's coming next. Even if you don't believe in rebirth, you believe some, because we just know we have this limited lifespan, and here's our chance. And afterwards, maybe there's no chance because there's no more anything, or it's going to be difficult because we might not be human, or we might be human, but we might not find a Zen center. practice place and opportunity. So it's like the conditions are so great. I think it's wonderful. This is a very positive. I really enjoy contemplating this. I try to every day, to some, in one form or another, to intentionally remember what a special opportunity this is, and I don't want to waste it. That's why it's helpful to contemplate that. Rob, did you have a question?
I was just going to say that the courage of the shepherd is not irrational.
How so?
Shepherds aren't reckless. They're not taking their flocks to dangerous places.
Mm-hmm. So almost like it's almost like trusting the sheep's wisdom, maybe. The shepherd's trusted, like, I actually don't really know how these sheep are going to realize this complete awakening, but like I'm just going to create the conditions, like a good field, a safe field for them to realize it, and they'll like and I trust that their Buddha nature will take care of the rest.
Well, or they've been there.
They've been, who's been there?
The shepherd's been there before.
Been to that field? Mm-hmm. You mean, if we're making the analogy to enlightenment, they've realized the way before? Mm-hmm. But I think part of the metaphor is that they haven't, right?
I don't know if that's necessarily true.
Because they say, they're going to go first, right? If the shepherds, I mean, we could.
They're going to go first, but
the sheep are.
That they don't know where they're going.
Hmm.
Well, Christianity, I guess, is sort of based on that. You know, Jesus is the good shepherd, so it has to know.
I mean, maybe from a Buddha nature point of view. We might say, like, the shepherd has this intuitive wisdom of where they need to be going, maybe we could say it like that too. They haven't actually realized it completely, but they know where they need to be going, and they know where how to guide the sheep there, because they know the direction that they're going, even though they haven't gotten there. Which is a little bit like my example of like, this sutra I really trusted, but I believe this, so please take this up and follow it completely. I don't know for sure that it leads to where it says it does, but please, if it works for you before me, which I hope it does, then help me and let me know.
So,
well, it just says that the attitude is they wish to establish all beings in perfect Buddhahood before achieving it for themselves, is the shepherd's way. So they haven't achieved Buddhahood. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, again, I'm not hearing that they don't know the place. So there would be a recklessness there, the way I hear it. The shepherd was allowing animals to go into a dangerous place.
Yeah, so I think that is part of it, and maybe it does come down to the question of the difference between bodhisattvas and Buddhas, which I just found, but I'm pretty sure it's in the Hotsu Bodhisattva. You can check this out, where Dogen makes this point that I was quite surprised to see, because he usually doesn't say this, but he gets into a whole discussion of bodhisattvas are not the same as Buddhas. You can check this out, I'll look for it. And I think he's just meaning that, like, once you arouse bodhicitta, then you practice on this bodhisattva path for a long time. I think he also gets into this time thing, which sometimes, of course, he doesn't, as we know. But in that essay, he's maybe taking a very conventional view of like, and you're practicing towards Buddhahood, and you're not Buddha yet. maybe the monks he was talking to were getting too into the non-dual ultimate view or something. Or attached to that view. But I was surprised when I came across that. It's kind of like that you're practicing these paramitas as a bodhisattva, and that's just different from a Buddha. So, again, maybe it's just semantics and getting too into the details here, but I think that's how I hear part of this shepherd story. I think part of what makes it difficult for me to take, or it's more controversial, when I hear, like, they're not a Buddha. There are a bodhisattva. The shepherd's a bodhisattva. Vowed with the greatest, most courageous bodhisattva, saying, you realize first, but they haven't really. So they have some wisdom in order to even be that way. And we could say, well, what's the difference between that wisdom and the wisdom of a Buddha?
Yeah, this is a magic thing where,
These are some of the things that are great to explore. This conversation is wonderful because it's bringing up all these nuances. And the thing about the firefly and the firestorm is also breaks down the difference between the bodhisattva and the Buddha too. And, of course, Dogen's into breaking down all distinctions even if it's falling into distinctionlessness, then he'll break that down by bringing up distinctions. But the traditional Indian Mahayana view that all this is kind of flowering out of, as I understand it, is that something like that the bodhisattva, you know, especially when we're talking about these bodhisattvas on these 10 bodhisattva stages, like the first stage that actually officially become a bodhisattva, or that's one version, is that when they have this direct insight into emptiness, combined with this compassionate wish, they become a bodhisattva. Another version is just to generate the bodhicitta, like in a non-contrived way, which usually comes after contriving it for a very long time. Then there's a genuine, spontaneous, like, oh no, this vow is, I'm not even trying. It's effortless. It's what is now, and this is all there is to do. When it's born for the first time, sometimes they say that's the bodhisattva. We might say, maybe those are the same. Maybe that is the realization of emptiness, actually. But part of the thing is that the realization of emptiness to become the bodhisattva, emptiness combined with compassion, is the same understanding as a Buddha. It's like it doesn't get any deeper, actually. They realize Buddha nature, that there's this mind is completely empty and boundless, and it appears as this world and all beings, and the appearance and the emptiness are inseparable. And so that realization is the same for the beginning bodhisattva and the Buddha. So in that way, Buddhas, there is no difference, but then there's other qualities of a Buddha besides their understanding that would be like fulfilled at the end of the bodhisattva path. Like being able to manifest the three Buddha bodies for benefiting beings. So, there's a lot. There's a lot to contemplate. And I think just contemplating it and thinking about bodhicitta like this is, for me, it's very joyful. And I appreciate everybody's questions and comments, because it's also like opening up the vision more and more, and thinking, wow, this is this awesome thing, this teaching basically of bodhicitta that appeared in this world at some point is an amazing occurrence. And then all of these, you know, practitioners contemplating this and practicing with it through all these centuries in different countries has led to this, and now we have this opportunity to look at it ourselves for another 5 days. May the precious mind of awakening arise where it has not arisen, and where it has arisen, may it not wane, but further and further increase. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are by